This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture and it's Mira Sivasodhi. Human trafficking is the second most lucrative trade in the world after drugs. And in conjunction with International Day of Remembrance of the Victims of Slavery, I have, of course, from Tanaganita, Irene Fernandez, who, you know, is going to talk about the role of shelters and women when it comes to human trafficking. Welcome to the show, Irene.
Thank you.
Irene, could you tell me about the shelter that, you know, Tanaganita first opened? And I understand you had to close it down at some stage and you have reopened it now, but the function of a shelter, really, what is it?
Right, Tanganita had a shelter way back in 1995, our first shelter. It was the first shelter for women who were trafficked as well as for positive women, because at that time we were also working with sex workers.
Mm-hmm. HIV positive.
Yeah, HIV okay. positive women, yes, that's okay. right, yeah. And so that shelter was initially funded by the Malaysian AIDS Council, who was getting funding from the Ministry of Health. Unfortunately, the shelter funding was stopped. What we did was, with the sex workers group, we had discussions and they decided that they would form their own organization and take over the shelter, which was fantastic for us, because that's part of the empowerment process as well.
Yep.
And so a new organization called WAKE was formed. And then later on, in 2007, we saw again the great need for shelter for women who were trafficked. And at that point, the government was just initiating the Anti-Trafficking in Persons Act. Mm-hmm. And we got our shelter going again, and we went on for 4 years, and then we had again problems with funding, and so we closed down the shelter temporarily to begin to focus on
gaining funds
again on reorganizing and funding of the shelter.
Okay.
We opened it last year.
Oh, fantastic.
And last year we sheltered 42 women in the shelter.
Who were rescued from human trafficking?
Yes. I think it's very important to recognize the role of shelters. I think the goal is dual. One, we say, is to facilitate a process whereby the victim becomes the survivor, meaning that she's no more in her mind a victim who can be abused, but she's a survivor wanting to live life again.
Yeah.
And so those who come to our shelter, we call them survivors, not victims. And the second one is the whole empowering process, whereby we build new capacities for the survivor so that she can live life again when she returns home.
Right. So to get reintegrated back into society.
Right.
Funny you said many of these survivors are psychologically traumatized, of course, but some suffer from what you call Stockholm syndrome, where, you know, the victim sympathizes with her abuser and then they want to go back working for the trafficker. What do you do in instances like that? Because that's what you said. You have to convince them to become a survivor. And these are some of the stumbling blocks. How do you deal with that?
I think you need to differentiate different types of women or different conditions in which women are trafficked. Now, we have women who are trafficked into forced prostitution. And that's where we find the syndicate control is tremendous. And that's where they are also told that if they escape and if they seek any alternative way of life, not only they will be hunted down, but the family as well. And I think this is the form of pressure that they get, and therefore they say that they want to go back. You know, so we really need to understand what are the conditions in which they were in, what kind of indoctrination that they have gone through, and the fear that has been instilled in them. There are others who are trafficked for labor, like domestic workers, and they have a different, again, a way of looking at themselves. And for them, their main concern is to get their wages, compensation, and go back to start life again. So there are different forms. Then you have women who have been brought in as through marriage, and then they find themselves they are in a exploitative condition, enslaved, and theirs is again a different resolution. If they have children, then they want to stay here and continue life here, but independently.
Right.
So we need to address the different situations.
So, you know, just not having a shelter, you need to have the manpower, you need to have the people who are experts, psychologists, you know, people who are familiar to rehabilitate these people so that they can, you know, become survivors and get reintegrated back in society. How do you manage that?
Oh, that's where the challenge is really, because we do not have sufficiently trained persons to address the psychological needs of counseling and the expertise in looking at trafficked persons. So what we do is we develop the training. We try and employ psychologists. We try and get people to do counseling professionally for us. But I think in all the stories that comes through, really what is important is the sisterhood that is built between the care providers and the women at the shelter.
Mm-hmm.
I find that is really a breakthrough when they begin to have confidence in us, and that we will then be with them in that journey of recovery and healing. And I think that is what we try and instill in the supervisors, the care providers, and we see that as a process of moving forward.
Are there other organizations that provide shelter for women who are trafficked?
Yes, we have the Good Shepherd Sisters who do provide shelter. And I think that we are only the two groups. Besides, currently, we have the government shelter.
Yes. Could you describe the government shelters? I mean, are they effective, would you say?
See, the government shelter, if we look at them, some of the concerns that we have is that the process of recovery is not there, and the tendency to treat them as part of an institution. The officers over there look at them as being there in an institution, and therefore the need to control to manage them. And then to get the evidence and then send them back. And I think that's where the problem is. Mm-hmm. Is that second is, I think, that the lack of access by NGOs to go and be with the women and really interact with them, which is different when you're a civil servant and you see it more as a task that you need to fulfill,
mm-hmm.
than the interaction and sisterhood that can be built from people outside. And so we have some concerns over government shelters. One of the things is that when we refer cases and women to the government shelter because of the case that needs to be addressed, we no longer have access to them. And I think this is one area of concern.
Okay. And when you talk about the victims who are coming to you, is there a certain age limit? Is there a certain age group that's coming to these shelters?
If we look at the whole feminization of migration and the women who are recruited, they're actually younger and younger today. And we have most of them are below 30 years of age, the high reproductive age. And there are also children below 18 who have come to us. And so you can see the trends are that they are younger. For reasons, one, the tendency to believe that they can be trained and therefore work better. And two, in the whole sex industry, the demand for younger and younger girls is very high.
Okay. Does that worry you? I mean, these numbers are increasing. The age is decreasing. I mean, what worries you most? What worries you most? I mean, you have the number of women being trafficked increasing. I mean, as I said earlier, human trafficking is now the second most lucrative trade in the world. The girls are getting younger and younger. I mean, what would you like? I mean, what are your thoughts on that? As a mother,
see,
of
my biggest
two,
concern is that there's a problem with our whole value system in which we address migrant labor. And particularly in terms of women, because where women migrants are concerned, it's the least protected areas that they go into, and therefore the perpetrators tend to get away from any kind of accountability and thus act with impunity. The second aspect is the whole dimension of corruption and the involvement of how enforcement agencies tend to work hand in glove with our perpetrators, with syndicates, with agents, and therefore tend to facilitate the growth of the industry in this. Another factor that we have not addressed effectively are both employers where domestic work is concerned. And the other factor is where clients of the sex workers or those who are forced into the sex trade, we have not addressed that effectively at all.
Okay. Have you, you know, had dealings, dialogue with government? Have you made steps forward, and you know, as part of Tanaganita, to see if we can help, you know, do more for human trafficking in this country?
Yes, we have done it in various ways. One is the whole awareness. We have also submitted our position papers and policy related to migrant labour, women migrant labour in particular, that unless and until we have a comprehensive policy on migrant workers, decisions will be ad hoc. And so we need to move away from that and to look at it in a more comprehensive way. The other aspect is to recognize domestic work as work. Currently, the Employment Act defines it as servant, and therefore you have a master-servant relationship. And so once you recognize as a worker, then the Employment Act brings about effective protection. And so employers of domestic workers will realize that they have an accountability under law. As it is, they don't have.
Okay.
And I think that's very, very fundamental for this. The other area that we are looking at is that there has to be more proactive intervention in addressing the sex industry. And I think some of the ways that we are working with in Selangor is that in the approval of entertainment centres, of hotels, of massage parlours, what kind of criteria, what do you look for before you approve? And the role of local councils in this process is very important. So that's one. Two is a seizure of properties where there is, you know, forced prostitution, where there is sex trafficking occurring, then you should seize that property. And part of the costs and compensation for the women who have been trafficked should come from there. And that gives accountability to the perpetrator, you see, which is not done correctly. We need to be less and less moralistic on the issue, because now the image that is constantly given is the women is the problem and not the industry and the client. And I think that there has to be a shift in that perspective in order to address it more effectively.
Coming up, we'll find out more about the role of shelters as far as human trafficking is concerned on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
You're listening to BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Good afternoon, it is The Bigger Picture and it's Mira Sivasodhi, Irene Fernandez of Tanaganita with me. We're discussing the role of shelters in human trafficking. Today is the International Day of Remembrance of the Victims of Slavery, and this 2013, the theme is Forever Free, Celebrating Emancipation. Any thoughts on this special day, Irene, International Day of Remembrance of the Victims of Slavery? I mean, do we celebrate it in a big way here in Malaysia? Do we even, you know that it exists?
I think we can celebrate it in a much more visible way, as we are currently doing. A lot of it is left to NGOs, and then there are some articles that appear. But I think it will be really very important for the government of the day to make a much more visible commitment during International Women's Day. And this is in particular to women workers and women migrants, because they are from another country. And therefore, all the more for International Women's Day to be relevant is to address this. It also reflects the struggle of women workers worldwide to determine their rights. And that's part of the International Women's Day celebration. Now, a lot of emphasis goes into ending violence against women, yep, which is very crucial and very important. But I think there is a need to address more and more the root causes of that violence, more than just addressing it as a crime. To address it as a crime is to bring about accountability. But if we look at the kind of sentencing that is happening, there is no effective jurisprudence framework that goes with the sentencing. And I think that is problematic. So what I would like to see is, we have ratified CEDAW in 1995, yet the substantive equality and women's rights are not effectively addressed. And I think that's where the concern is. We look at saying women are educated now, but what does that education mean? Are we in the decision-making areas? And we are not, which means there's something wrong with the system whereby women still can't be the decision maker. Mm-hmm. And if we cannot be the decision maker, equality is not there. Right.
But do you see us getting, have we gotten somewhere at least, as opposed to maybe 10 years ago?
For the level of development we have achieved, I think I will still say it's a long way. And the problem is we tend to bring cultural aspects as impediments to that growth. And I think we should move away and look at the women, one, as a human being, and therefore the rights are all the same rights. Two, that she has specific rights because she is a woman, and she has her motherhood accountability, responsibility. She has also a specific forms of violence that affect her, and therefore that needs to be looked into effectively.
Just to come back to shelters, Irene, you've mentioned just what? Good Shepherd and yourself, and of course government shelters. I mean, this is so few. That is certainly not enough. What are the consequences of not having enough shelters in the country?
I think the key consequences are that there are so many women out there who cannot get enough support and therefore are not able to assert their rights, to seek redress and to build their lives. And I think that's problematic, because if we look at we have, almost 4 million migrant workers, out of which easily more than 45% would be women, or more even now. And yet, we have so little initiative in reaching out and having these shelters. And I think because of the lack of such shelters, we have very few women coming forward, and therefore the exploitation continues. Mm-hmm. So if we want women to free themselves, we need to have more shelters. For example, in Sarawak, it's so difficult. And there is this lack of the shelters there. Now, similarly in the East Coast, in the North, there is none. And so the referral becomes very, very difficult, especially if we want to file a case. Now, in the North or in the South, you know, we have to travel all the way to take the survivor there for the case and come back. And that is not very cost-effective at all. Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, there is a need for shelters. But I think in that context, funding is a key factor. Mm-hmm. And what I would like to see is more and more Malaysians seeing this need of giving life to a woman who has been affected, who has been trafficked, who has been in a condition of slavery, that we can play an effective role by contributing to the rescue and to sheltering that particular woman or girl child.
Yeah, I mean, I think you mentioned in your previous interviews the cost of rescuing a woman who has been trafficked. How much was it again, Irene?
You see, ours is we need about 300 ringgit per person for that rescue process, which is not much. And that's what we did at a conference organized by one of the churches, where they had little dolls, and they said, okay, you get a doll and you buy a doll for 300 ringgit, and you will be able to contribute to rescuing one victim. And that has worked, and that's how we have started our shelter. And I think that's a tremendous way, because the issue is not on the number that we have rescued, but that in rescuing one person, we have saved one life. Mm-hmm. And that is tremendous.
Do these shelters really work in protecting these women from, you know, going back or preventing them from being trafficked once again?
It is difficult to say because some of them have been able to integrate effectively into back home in the country, not in their own community, because that's where the risk is again of being re-trafficked. But working with other NGOs in the source country, we've been able to reintegrate them, and thereby they continue their capacity and so forth. There has been success stories in this aspect. While there have been some who find that they have no choice because the poverty continues to exist and the challenge is still there, mm-hmm. And some of them feel that they may not face the same risk as they did before, and therefore they do re-migrate, but not into Malaysia, but some other country.
Okay, all right. So then it happens once again. But then again, you just do what you can, isn't it? After which, it's really something
yes,
that's beyond your control.
Yes, I think as long as we are able to build their capacities and give them the confidence for decision making, I think that's how much we can do.
Mm-hmm. You know, Irene, you spoke about 300 ringgit for, you know, rescuing or giving a trafficked victim an option in life. What about reintegrating them into society? Doesn't that cost more money as well?
You see, we are a working partnership with groups in the source countries, and therefore they raise money for the reintegration. What we do is we develop the skills that are needed for. So, for example, some of them have learned to make jewellery, mm-hmm. you know, and then we provide the kit to them. And that's one skill that we hope they can go back and continue. Or they are making bags. You know, so things like that, where while they are at the shelter, they do these things, mm-hmm. and some of them have taken up language skills, and so these are ways of how we are improving them. One a survivor who just went back last Friday, she now speaks very good English. And she says, now I'm going to work in an NGO to continue my work with those who are affected in the same way I was.
Wonderful.
I think that's wonderful.
Yeah. What about our legal process, Irene? Does it cater for the human trafficked victim?
The legal framework?
The legal process.
No.
Because a lot of them come to you in the shelter, and you know it could mean they could wait 14 days for their case or even more before they're called to court. So do you feel the legal process actually caters for the fact that this victim has been trafficked?
That's one of the challenging issues we have. And the legal process takes a very long time. And many of the women who are trafficked, they're very anxious to return home. And many of them initially feel that the safe space is back home and not here, you know, to be reunited with their loved ones, and rightly so. But what we try and do is to convince them that they need to. Now, in terms of trafficking, if we use the Anti-Trafficking in Persons Act, then we address the issue of the criminal dimension. And what is missing is the human rights framework within the Anti-Trafficking in Persons Act. And so what we explain to the survivor is that there's this act, and what can she get from this act? And then there is other labor laws where she can get unpaid wages and various other claims and so forth. And this is what will happen if she uses the different systems for redress. And quite often, the women tend to choose the labor dimension of it because they say they can get money. And they can use that money to start life again.
Right.
So what is really missing in the legal framework of the Anti-Trafficking Persons Act is the compensation and reparation that's important to bring about justice for the survivor.
Is there an example you'd like to, you know, share with me of a success story of, you know, a human trafficked victim?
There are many successes, and I remember this girl from Uzbekistan who was trafficked into forced prostitution, and she was below 18 years old, and we were able to rescue her out, and she stayed in our shelter. It took a while before we could link up with groups in the country, in Uzbekistan, who can provide her support and so forth. Language was very challenging. But when she left, I always remember what she said, "Thank you for giving me life again. I would have been dead in the hands of the traffickers." And I think that kind of told me that saving that life is all that we want to do. And that is the passion in which we move forward. We have also success stories of a girl who had killed her trafficker because she was going to be raped, and then he was forcing her. And but she was charged for murder and was going to be sentenced. We took up the case, and with the help of the Human Rights Commission, she got freed. Meanwhile, she stayed in our shelter. Today, she has a very nice little restaurant in Medan. And I think that is really wonderful for us.
Do you think they ever recover from the abuse and the fact that they were human trafficked?
A total recovery takes a long time, and it needs a lot of support throughout. But women also have the power to recover, and we must recognize that power within us. And I think many of them who are able to get support in that journey do actually recover and start life. It's really those who lose the support that tend to go into another crisis situation of depression. And I think, and that's where we see the importance of building partnerships with various groups, both here in Malaysia and in the source country.
What are your hopes, Irene, to keep the shelter open this time around and keep it up and running?
All right. My hope is that more and more Malaysians would come forward to provide the support we are looking for, both in terms of money and provide support to rescue and shelter the girl. And secondly, is for volunteers who will come and help us to develop the capacities and to empower the women who are at the shelter.
How do we get in touch with you? Is there a way we can contribute towards the shelter?
Yes, actually we have a PayPal account in the Hong Kong Bank that you could contribute towards too. And we also have a specific account where you can call us and then we could tell you and you could bank in your contribution. Or send us a check saying that this is for the shelter. But I think every little effort made at the end of the day is a hope that you give to one who has been forced into a condition of exploitation.
Is there a phone number, Irene?
Yes. You can call our office at 603-7770-3671 or 91.
Okay. And is there a website?
Yes, www.tenaganita.net.
Fantastic.
We're also on Facebook.
Sure. That phone number once again, 03-7770-3671 or 3691. It was a pleasure having you on, Irene.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming in. Irene Fernandez from Tenaganita on the role of shelters as far as human trafficking is concerned on The Bigger Picture BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.